Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We're continuing to update the situation in Japan at Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, where Japan Electric, TEPCO, now admits that 35 to 50% of the fuel had melted down at three reactors as of weeks ago. Michael Marriott of NIRS, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, joins us. At their website, NIRS.org, there are continual updates, including one May 20th, explaining that more is known at this point about the meltdown at Plant 1, a MOX fuel plant that was leaking plutonium in addition to other radioactive particles. As had been reported to us earlier by nuclear expert Arjun Makhijani, there was damage to Unit 1 from the earthquake even before the devastating tsunami. We had discussed the crack leading to the plant and his hypothesis that this was the case. And you can find that interview and others at talknationradio.org. Michael Marriott, thanks for joining us again. And just tell us, the media is using the term meltdown more once again. Can you just tell us what exactly that means?
Sure. The nation's media, the world's media, seems to have just figured out that the reactors that Fukushima melted down, actually these meltdowns took place in the second week of March. And what we've been seeing since then are the after effects and ramifications of that. It's actually surprising to me that it's surprising to the media because, you know, we've seen very large radiation releases. We've seen the area around Fukushima made uninhabitable, you know, as far as 25 miles away to the northwest. And, you know, we've seen exactly what happens when you have a reactor meltdown. And, I mean, even Tokyo Electric Power, for all their other failings, was saying quite some time ago that fuel had melted. The new information is really just confirmation that fuel melted, quite probably majority to all the fuel in the three reactors that were fueled at the time, melted, dropped to the bottom of the pressure vessel, and melted holes into the pressure vessel, which allowed it to leak out. Tokyo Electric Power's response was pretty appropriately to try to keep the reactors cool, so they were pouring tons and tons of water into these reactor buildings for weeks. And what has happened now is that because the containments were breached, the pressure vessels were breached, that water has been leaking back out. And of course, since it was in contact with the molten fuel, very highly radioactive, it's been pooling up in the bottom of the reactors, in the groundwater, and of course some of it's gone into the Pacific Ocean, and so it's just an ungodly mess to clean up.
The rods melted down, you know, incomplete. I mean, they disintegrated, went to the floor, but then we don't know how much the radioactive, let's say, burn, if you want to call it that, but we don't know how much the reaction that might have occurred then caused what some would refer to as the China syndrome, you know, the continued burning down, I think at least some level of earth underneath that plant has been breached, right?
That is one of the things that remains unknown, is whether it's actually gone all the way through the buildings and the containment structures, or whether it's pooled at the bottom of them, you know, covered in some water, in some cases quite a lot of water, and the sort of leaking through the water, you know, it's not clear whether the fuel itself is actually melted through the buildings. I haven't seen anything that would confirm that, but clearly, you know, the highly radioactive water has gotten out.
And Michael Marriott at NIRS, it's www.nirs.org, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. You've been doing a kind of press update as often as you can, right? Can you just talk about that question of what people know and what they don't know? Because it does seem as if there's this big gap in our understanding. And, you know, I want to say that it's related to the fact that the federal government and state agencies are not providing us with these routine updates on the situation in Japan.
Well, we've actually complained quite a bit to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is, of course, getting daily updates from the Japanese and from their own people in Japan for not releasing their information, not doing an effective communication job, and that leads to rumors, and it leads to speculation, and it's led to an extraordinary number of Freedom of Information Act requests to the NRC, which is actually quite burdensome on them, and we've pointed out to them, well, if they just released the information, maybe they wouldn't have these kinds of problems. But in some fairness, Tokyo Electric Power has not been particularly good at releasing information. The Japanese government has not been particularly good at releasing information. And so a lot of the information that's developed has been based on somewhat stronger than speculation. It's been based on experts taking a look at what's happening, taking a look at the radiation readings, and trying to make sense of what is going on. And, you know, that there have been a few surprises that have come out over the last few weeks. For example, we believed earlier that the Unit 4 fuel pool had gone dry and caught on fire and released large amounts of radiation. Last week, video of the fuel pool was released, and it's actually in pretty good shape. And clearly, that didn't happen at Unit 4. Now, the building's a mess because it did suffer a hydrogen explosion, but that hydrogen explosion apparently occurred because of shared facilities with Unit 3. Unit 4 had no fuel in the core, so it wasn't generating its own hydrogen. So it was actually problems at Unit 3 that caused the hydrogen explosion at Unit 4 that has severely damaged the building to the point where, you know, one of the Japanese utility, TEPCO's major projects right now is trying to shore up that building to make sure it doesn't collapse, which would be a huge calamity. So, you know, there have been some surprises, but it's, you know, very clear that, you know, they have experienced, you know, meltdown is not a technical term, but they've experienced three meltdowns at Units 1 through 3. The fuel pool at Unit 3 is a mess. Clearly, there was an explosion in that fuel pool, and that probably accounted for a large amount of the radiation that was released into the area. You know, one thing I'll just point out is that most of the radiation was sent out over the ocean and caught up in wind currents and sent around the world. If we were in a situation where that radiation had gone out over land in Japan, we'd be looking at a very different kinds of consequences than we are now.
Well, and it's not over. I mean, you were talking about containment, and what I thought as you were saying that was, right now, they're trying to contain water. I mean, they're just trying to keep it cool still. I mean, that's where we were in early March, right?
Well, they are trying to figure out what to do with the thousands and thousands and thousands of gallons of very highly radioactive water that has accumulated there. The reactors themselves are so radioactive that workers can only go in the buildings for very short times. They can't really get to this water, and they don't really know what to do with it. Meanwhile, they do have to still keep the reactors cool. The temperature levels inside the reactors remain above the boiling point, which is 100 degrees centigrade. They're not high above the boiling point, but they do remain above it. We've seen some temperature spikes over the last couple of weeks where the temperature in one reactor or another goes up until they put more water in it. So they still have to keep these cores cool. That means, you know, putting more water in. And there's just nowhere to put it, and it's not a situation that the world has faced before, that any utility has faced before. So it's a huge job. In addition, they have to get to the point where there's a self-sustaining cooling system to make sure that the temperatures get below 100 degrees centigrade and stay there. That doesn't include, you know, spraying water in from outside. And those systems basically have to be built and installed in a highly radioactive environment. So, you know, this idea that the situation will be stable and under control in, you know, 6 to 9 months is looking increasingly unlikely. I mean, we're looking, you know, in terms of cleanup, of course, we're looking at an accident that is going to be around for decades.
A lot of people have asked me, as I've covered this story, about the radioactive materials going out into the sea. And what they've said is, well, where does it go from there? I mean, in other words, it's going to contaminate the atmosphere, the water, and the environment, and there's a lot of it. So while it may have saved lives, of course, that this radioactive airborne stuff didn't go straight into Japan and the population systems, but we still have a lot of radioactivity now in the environment. What does that mean to our health and to the people living either in Asia or, let's say, North America?
We have an old slogan that dilution is not the solution to pollution, and that certainly applies here. On the other hand, the fact is that the Pacific Ocean is a large ocean, and airborne, we're talking about, you know, thousands of miles and lots of different wind currents, so that where we're seeing the, you know, high levels, the concerning levels, are close to the Fukushima site, and they're going to continue to be high there for quite a long time to come. In terms of the ocean, that there was a map I saw that showed the where the highest seawater levels are, and, you know, they are, as expected, you know, in northeast Japan, you know, off the coast of northeast Japan, extending out a while. Greenpeace has the Rainbow Warrior ship out off the coast, and they've found fairly high levels of cesium in seaweed quite a few miles from the coast. And that's significant because seaweed is an important part of the Japanese diet. In terms of worldwide, it's sort of an additional burden on people. There's not much you can do about it, but, you know, the same way that radiation from Chernobyl has been circling the globe for the past 25 years, sort of entering the background radiation that we're all exposed to, now so is radiation from Fukushima adding to the background radiation burden.
One of the areas of grave concern right now, of course, is stopping whatever nuclear reaction might be going on that's causing materials to leak out into the ocean. Now, TEPCO said they fixed a hole in the reactor containment vessel, right?
No. Last week there was a leak they found, I believe it was from the turbine building of Unit 3, leaking directly into the ocean, and they fixed that. Fixing holes in the pressure vessel is going to be a whole different level of job. The pressure vessels are below ground level. They're extraordinarily radioactive, and even more so now than they were under normal operation. Fixing holes that may be in those is a job nobody's ever tried before.
And just fill us in more on that. Talk exactly about what you mean, what this pressure provides. I mean, I take it that's the radioactive process that goes on when they create power, right?
Inside these shattered buildings, there is a reactor pressure vessel, which is made of steel. It's usually several inches thick, and this is where the fuel rods sit and where the nuclear reaction takes place under normal operation. What happened when they lost the capability to cool the reactors, water stopped flowing through, the fuel heated up, it melted, it dropped down to the floor of this pressure vessel and began, you know, essentially melting through these several inches of steel. And clearly at Unit 1, and it is believed that both at Units 2 and 3 as well, it melted through and put holes in this so that the fuel was then able to begin leaking out into the larger containment that sits out, that sort of covers this pressure vessel, that sits around it, and as well as the fuel leaking out, the water that the utility was pouring in to try to keep it cool after some time when they were able to, you know, spray water in rather than use the cooling system, which no longer worked, that water also was going out through these holes and accumulating at the underneath the pressure vessel, and not what it's designed to do. It's not what's designed to happen, and it's causing, we have thousands and thousands of gallons of extremely radioactive water underneath each of these three reactors, and molten fuel. Now, it's not like the meltdown is continuing. The temperature levels are not that high. We're not seeing additional melting of fuel But we are seeing continued steam releases because, again, the temperatures are above the boiling level. So the water is boiling and releases the steam and releases radiation as it does that. And you can see there's a live webcam of the Fukushima site up on the internet, and you can watch the reactors all day and night if you want. You can see fairly continuous steam releases, and those steam releases are radioactive steam.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith, and we're speaking with Michael Marriott of NIRS, NIRS.org. That's the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Now a little Courtney Dow with the Radiation Blues.
It's the 6th of August. The sky is overcast. Each breath is a gift. I pray won't be the last. I'm counting breaths since 1945. I wonder if we'll let us stay alive. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Fukushima.
Now, we can't help but be reminded of what happened when, the Deepwater Horizon exploded and people were gradually accepting the idea that massive amounts of oil were flowing into the ocean. Here now we have something even worse and much harder to clean up. Now, with TEPCO, we've also heard that somehow a fourth reactor that wasn't operating when the quake hit in March was also damaged. And what Tokyo Electric has said is that they theorize anyway that hydrogen somehow traveled to this site from an adjacent reactor through pipes and vents. And, we've just interviewed Paul Blanche, a whistleblower and someone who's very familiar with how these plants operate. He was working at them for most of his working life. And so in that sense, he has already warned us that at some of these aging nuclear plants in the United States, in New England, that he's studied, the problem is the piping, because they're not secure anymore. They're old. They're not well maintained. Is that in some way, does that resonate with some thoughts you might have had about what's happened here, that it's just not maintained properly?
Paul would certainly know more about the shape of maintenance at the reactor sites than I would, because as you said, he has been working at them. He knows it very well. I think one issue that has not really been looked at yet in the United States, and it's something we're going to be pressing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do in terms of their review of the lessons from Fukushima, is this concept of putting several reactors together at one site. In Connecticut, for example, you have Millstone, which originally had three reactors. Now there's only two operating, but we have a number of multi-unit reactor sites in the U.S., and we have proposals at several of these to add more reactors. And this concept of multi-units sharing facilities and the additional problems that can cause under accident situations needs a closer look. As you mentioned, as I mentioned earlier, the explosion at the Unit 4 reactor apparently was caused by hydrogen buildup from the Unit 3 reactor and running through shared piping. We have in Alabama the Browns Ferry nuclear site, which is run by the Tennessee Valley Authority, that has three of these Fukushima-style reactors, these General Electric Mark I reactors is what they're called. It has three of them in the same building. And, the implications of that are something that really needs a closer look, because when you have an accident at one reactor, if it can cause, the kind of explosion we've seen that, has destroyed the Unit 4 building at Fukushima, you know, that's something that hasn't been considered in the safety reviews of these reactors by the U.S., and it's something that desperately needs to be. And it also needs to be done before there's any thought of building new reactors at existing reactor sites. For example, we have in Georgia the Vogtle nuclear reactors. There's two of them at one site there, and Georgia Power wants to build two more adjacent to them. Has already received taxpayer loans, or received a promise of taxpayer loans to do so. And, you know, before that happens, well, we don't obviously don't think that should happen at all, but before that happens, there needs to be a much better review of the implications of putting four reactors right next to each other.
And your organization, NIRS, has also petitioned the government to use more stringent monitoring to determine just how much radioactive iodine risk there is to U.S. milk and U.S. water. Now, that seems like such an obvious thing that we would assume to be going on. Talk about the problems that you've identified with that system.
Well, the biggest problem right now is that the enhanced monitoring that was being done for the last couple of months has ended. The Environmental Protection Agency has gone back to their normal non-accident radiation monitoring, which means testing milk, for example, once every 3 months or so. And we understand that the reason why they've done this is that the readings in April were decreasing, as one would expect, and in most parts of the country were getting non-detectable readings, and it does cost some additional money to do these readings. However, in our view, with the accident, you know, clearly not over, we believe, you know, this kind of enhanced radiation monitoring serves two purposes. One, since the accident isn't over, it does provide us with knowledge that, you know, if there are new releases that maybe aren't publicized in Japan but do make their way over the U.S., we'll be able to find out about it. And two, you know, it does provide some reassurance to the American public that if they're doing readings and not finding anything, well, I think that's good news for the public, and they'll want to know that. A lot of people, you know, are quite nervous about the milk they're drinking, the water they're drinking, and the food they're eating. And maybe some of those concerns would be allayed if monitoring were going on and finding nothing. And if they were finding something, well, you know, people have a right to know that.
Now, finally, I think one of the most interesting parts of the story this week is the way that officials in Japan have responded to what they've learned on an ongoing basis. You know, as TEPCO has been more forthcoming with data, these officials have gotten angry at times, you know, and have, you know, lashed out at some of these officials, and they've had to publicly apologize on many occasions now. But one of the things that's happened is that first, Japanese officials said they were continuing their nuclear plans. They were going forward with plans for more nuclear facilities. And then there was a sudden pullback from that position, and we heard that they were going to scale back on any plans for more nuclear facilities for Japan and review existing plants. And then now there's been a reversal again, and they're talking about, in fact, depending more on nuclear in the future. And I think we're seeing something very similar in the United States, where we're looking at real economic demands that are made because of the extent of the power that we need to run our countries in this, you know, advanced technological world. And so people are saying we can't do it without nuclear, and so they're going forward. Now, at that juncture, the one thing we seem to have as a measure to use to hold companies more accountable on safety issues is taxes. And not surprisingly, you know, taxes and also subsidies. And those two things are under review when it comes to the oil industry. And from what we can tell, even runaway profits on the part of, you know, the big oil companies of the world are not sufficient that they're willing to give up these subsidies or pay more taxes. Can we take a lesson from that when it comes to nuclear?
Well, we certainly should take a lesson from that in Congress. The appropriations committees are working over the next couple of weeks to determine the next year's Department of Energy funding. And one of the things they're considering is the nuclear loan program. And President Obama has, as he did last year, asked for a tripling of that program, adding $36 billion to it to give to loans for nuclear utilities to build new reactors. And he did not get the money last year, and we're working hard to make sure he does not get the money this year. And in fact, we believe that not only should the program not be increased, but it should actually be ended. And the 20 or so billion dollars that the Department of Energy has for this program, none of which has actually been spent, $8 billion of it has been promised, but none of it's been spent, that money should be rescinded and returned to the federal budget. You know, use it for deficit reduction or something. So this is actually a very critical time, and we'll have a better sense of, you know, where things are in a month or so. But, you know, we're encouraging people to contact their Congress members and tell them we don't want our tax money, our tax dollars, loaned to wealthy nuclear utilities to build new reactors in the United States. In fact, we don't want new reactors at all. And you know, the American people are certainly with us on this. A public opinion poll that came out in March found that 73% are opposed to this nuclear loan program, or are opposed, you know, they may not know specifics about the program, but they're opposed to the idea of their tax dollars being spent on new reactors. An ABC News, Washington Post poll that came out in April found that 64% of the American people do not want new reactors, period, no matter who pays for them. And Congress hasn't really heard this yet, and Congress won't hear it until the public tells them this directly. And that's why we encourage, you know, people to call, write, email their Congress members. And you can certainly do that from our website, NIRS.org. It's really crucial that that happen right now, and that, you know, we don't make the same mistakes that were made with the BP oil spill that seemed to go on forever. And, you know, now a year later, the oil companies are right back where they were before. We're not going to let that happen with the nuclear industry.
Michael Marriott, thank you for taking our call again and helping us understand this ongoing catastrophe.
No, thank you.
We've been speaking with Michael Marriott, the executive director and chief spokesman at NIRS, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS.org. Finally, there's been a new development in a story we learned of last week from our guest, nuclear expert Paul Blanch. He's been working to challenge licensing at Vermont Yankee Nuclear Plant. And on May 24th, Natural Resources Secretary Deb Markowitz explained that a water quality permit governing wetlands and runoff at the reactor would be expired when the plant license expires in March. The owner of the plant, Entergy Corp, disagrees with her assessment, but apparently the NRC skipped a step when it relicensed Vermont Yankee. And this is a revelation that could lead to delays. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.